How's it going, everybody? I'm Eric Panecki.
I'm David Choi.
And I'm John Libretti.
And welcome to the Deals and Dollars podcast.
The three of us are real estate executives in the New York City metro area. Every week, we bring on the best real estate investors and entrepreneurs we know to talk about how they made it in the business, how they sourced their deals, and most importantly, how they make their dollars.
Quick disclaimer, the views and opinions expressed on this podcast are for informational purposes only and should not be construed as an offer to buy or sell any securities or to make or consider any investment or course of action. All right, let's get into it.
Let's ride!
All right, today we have a really, really awesome guest, Drew Coffin. He's the co-founder and CEO of Ness Property Management. They've been around for just 3 years, but they have 1,600 units under management, about $50 million AUM as an owner-operator. Their investment strategy is really simple. Value add in Class C neighborhoods, tertiary markets, and their superpower is finding deals, scaling, and really getting the best out of the business strategy and these assets through vertical integration. Drew, I really appreciate it, man. It's an honor to have you on the show. How are you doing today?
I'm good, man. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, it's my pleasure. Let's jump right into it. Drew, what drew you into real estate? How'd you get started?
Yeah, so, well, a little bit of background. I'm from Iowa City, Iowa, and that's currently where we do business as well today. I graduated from the University of Iowa. While I was in college, I was trying to figure out what I wanted to do, you know, for a career, job, whatever it may be. I always had an entrepreneurial spirit, I guess you would say. And that's what I went to school for. So my junior year of college, I started getting really into real estate. And I basically just Googled how to get into real estate and become an investor. And the first thing I clicked on was just start in property management. And so I just went online and started applying at property management jobs. I found a job locally here in Iowa City and really spent my junior and senior year of college working for a property management company, learning the business. I would show apartments, lease them, handle maintenance requests. And I got to know the owners at that time as well. So I kind of got to see the whole scale of how you run a property management company at a young age. I also got my real estate license at that time as well. So at that point, I knew it was something I wanted to do. I didn't know how quick I could build it or really how to do that part of it. But I knew I wanted to get into real estate and investing. So when I graduated from the University of Iowa, I believe it was 2016, I joined a company called the Tailwind Group, which was a student housing property management and development company. And for 3 years or so, I basically just traveled the Midwest and a little bit all over the country developing student housing properties. And at that time is when I started investing myself. So in December of 2017, I bought my first single family house with it had a little guest house behind it, and I turned it into a rental property. And so that was my first kind of jump into actual ownership of it. But while I was at Tailwind Group, I learned all about development, how to vertically integrate a company with construction, management, leasing, all of that. And so I really learned a lot at my time there on how to do the actual business side of real estate and investing. So it was right around end of 2019, early 2020. I joined two of my buddies and we started Nest Property Management, where we had about 600 units that they owned or I owned collectively, a little bit of both. And then we kind of just grew up from there. We did acquire a property management company that had about 400 units that was here locally. And then since then, we've just been adding on. And a lot of it's actually just been through word of mouth. What we realized, and I'm kind of dragging this on, but what we realized in property management was there's a lot of local mom and pop shops that have been around a long time. And it was kind of just status quo. And I think a lot of cities see that as well. We wanted to bring in a kind of a modern age property management company that would communicate better with the owners, be more transparent, and just be, you know, as hands-on with the owners as we could. And so we pushed to do that every day through reporting back to the owners and trying to have that constant communication with them, or at least what they want from us, we give to them. So that's kind of how we have scaled so quick on the property management side. But yeah, and then basically over the last 2.5 years or so while we were doing the property management company, we obviously are out in the market finding deals as well. So we've scaled. Personally, today I have 134 units that I have 100% equity of myself. And then I'm partnered with my two business partners on another 700 or so units. So we've grown a lot. And a lot of that has been through using our property management company as a source for us to scale the business, because we have the back end support to do that. So it's been very beneficial.
Well, that's a really impressive background, Drew. Thanks for sharing. I find that you did something similar to what I did when I got started was just get your feet wet in the business anywhere you can, right? And I remember when I was looking into getting started in real estate, all of the websites were telling me, go work for a property manager. That's where you're going to really learn the nitty gritty. Unfortunately, no one gave me a job in property management. So something I had to learn through just failures. But yeah, that's a great background. So one thing that stuck out to me that you did was you bought right out of entrepreneurship. You guys acquired a property management business. Tell me about that. Like, how did that even happen?
Yep. So before that, it was myself and the two partners. And the only thing we were really managing was our own stuff. And we had the desire to get into the more of the third party side because we saw the need. And we figured the best way to scale it quickly was to actually just go out and acquire a local company. And that gave us a big boost of 400 doors right off the bat. And we got to keep the staff in place. So it was a little bit easier on that front as well. We didn't have to go out and hire a bunch of staff day one. So basically right out the door, we started the company and we acquired this local company at 400 doors. And then it's really just scaled up from there. And using those owners that we bought from that company, we've used them for word of mouth. And they've also helped us grow quite a bit just with local investors that they knew as well. So
wow,
yeah, that's kind of why we did it, was just to get scale right on day one. And it was it obviously worked out pretty well.
That's a really smart idea. Do you mind? I mean, I know this isn't what it's for, but I'm just so curious now. What did that deal, how did you find that property management company? What did you do for due diligence to say, hey, this is what I'm going to value this at? And was it just like a transitionary period in the owner's life that they were willing to sell, or did you really have to kind of sell them? What did that deal look like?
Kind of funny story. It was actually the company that I worked for in college.
Wow.
After like 6 months, and I got to know the owner at that time. And at the time he was getting a little bit older, and I knew he would probably want to sell at some point down the road. And so once me and my two partners started talking about creating this property management company, it was basically my first call. And I called him and I just said, hey, you know, we're going to do this and we're looking to acquire a company. And he said it was his time to retire. So that's kind of how that came about. So yeah, I bought the company I used to work for, which is kind of a funny story.
That's amazing.
And the hard part of valuing a property management company is you don't know the value because the contracts are year to year, more or less. So how we valued it is we looked at all of the contracts, the property management contracts with the owners. We looked at their monthly management fees and their maintenance income. And then we actually looked at the timeline of those owners and how long they were with the company. And so that's how we valued the company. Was luckily a lot of his owners had been owners there for like 10, 15 years. There's a lot of really long-term owners. So we knew there wasn't a lot of turnover. And we knew also that we were going to bring in a new modern today's day and age property management company that these owners would actually enjoy. And so we looked at every contract. We made sure that they were long-term owners. We didn't want to see a bunch of recent owners just coming on, because I would assume that would mean they were just trying to pump up the value of the property or of the company. And we looked at all the financials as far as income on the management side, which is obviously reoccurring revenue, and then the maintenance side as well. It's more or less the same every single month, just depending on how many maintenance guys you have and the properties you have under management. So that's how we looked at it. And we've actually contacted, you know, it's something we do now is we look at acquiring other companies. So we've reached out to quite a few other property management companies and had talks with them. And a lot of the time they will want to get out when they're looking to retire. So you have a pretty good idea as far as when companies may sell. And I think it's a very scalable thing if somebody wanted to do that. There's thousands of property management companies. I know when I was traveling for Tailwind Group, we would go in and look at all these local companies. A lot of them are mom and pop owned, and a lot of them haven't changed at all for the last 20 years. And if you can just start the communication with them and get to know them, I mean, you can really scale a property management company quick and really be a profitable company from finding these. And you just have to know what you're looking for, and you have to be willing to go out there and, you know, be willing to talk to them.
That's freaking awesome. That's amazing. We've had a bunch of guests on the show, but no one's quite acquired their ex-boss's companies before. So that's amazing, Drew. Did you buy it? Like, what were the terms of that acquisition?
Yeah, so we did buy it in cash. Well, we took out a loan from the bank to buy it. A lot of times what you'll see on these contracts is let's, for example, like half the money up front. And then after 12 months, let's say, if all those contracts stay there, you'll pay the other half, just so you don't buy the company, then all your clients leave. This owner did not want to do that. He was just looking to get out of the business. So he was willing to sell it at a little bit of a discount, and we just paid it all up front. And luckily we've kept basically all of his clients that
he
purchased from him. So yeah, that's more or less how he did it. I would say be careful when you're buying a property management company with the fact that, one, you need to make sure they don't open up another company. So you want to make sure that's all taken care of. And two, you want to make sure those contracts are going to stay for a couple years if you're going to be paying especially a premium on a company, because your revenue can basically be cut in half at any time if those owners decide to leave once you acquire it. So we were very transparent with those new owners. We got a hold of all of them right away and just made sure that they felt comfortable with the change and that basically nothing was going to change except we were going to try to make their experience better. So that's kind of how we went about it.
That's fascinating. That's fast. So you bought it, you took out a loan to acquire the property management business. Luckily, all the clients stayed on. What did you do post-acquisition or pre-acquisition to make sure that the systems that you were implementing and the customer service and the communication was there with the existing clients so that that you had a 0% attrition rate upon buying the company?
Yeah. Yep. So, and we got to keep all of their staff, which actually helped quite a bit because that staff knew the tenants for once. So they knew all the properties and the tenants, and then they also knew the owners, and the accounting staff was staying. So all of the reporting wasn't going to drastically change on the owner side. So everything would look the same. They used AppFolio. We used AppFolio. And one thing we implemented day one was our monthly. So kind of how it's set up is they each get a report on the 20th of the month, which shows their profit and loss statement. And that's when they get their distribution for the month. And on the 15th of each month, we send out owner reports, which basically goes over all of the units, the maintenance that has basically happened over the past 30 days, any tenants that haven't paid rent, so they're aware of what's going on. And basically any other issues that are happening at their property. Because what we were finding is, and when we talked to all of these owners and other owners that are with other property management companies, the biggest, I guess, thing that would upset them was the fact that they would get that report on the 20th of the month and they wouldn't know that their tenant hadn't paid rent yet. And they're all expecting, you know, if they own one house, they're expecting that $1,000 a month to cover their mortgage and whatever else. And they wouldn't know. And then they would get that report and there'd be no money there to distribute. So we're constantly sending them these reports. The 15th, they get a very detailed report. Typically on the 6th of the month, rent is due by the 5th, or we send out the eviction notices. So on the 6th of the month, we are notifying them of any delinquent tenants. That way they're aware that those tenants haven't paid rent this month. And we also let them know what we're doing to get that money. But we just rolled out communication day one. They weren't receiving that before we took over. They were just getting that one report a month, which was their distribution. So the additional reporting to them, if anything, just helps let them know that we're taking care of their property. And I think that's what kept all those owners around. And they, you know, none of them even considered probably leaving at that time just because it was a better service than what they had before.
Awesome. Awesome. All right. Let's I detracted us a little bit, but that was an awesome story. And I had to dig in a little bit out of my own curiosity, but let's move on to the next question, Drew. In today's market, it's so hard to find good deals. And we spoke a little bit before we started recording and you just closed on a ton of units. They're unbelievable deals. How are you sourcing them?
Yeah. So how we're sourcing a lot of deals, especially early on, it was directly contacting the owners through phone calls, some mailers. We don't do a great job at it. A lot of times it's just me picking up the phone and calling them. And then I'll also text them and try to build some sort of rapport with them. And so that's basically how we did it. And we're in two markets, Cedar Rapids, Iowa, and Iowa City, Iowa. Collectively, it's about 450,000 people or so. We're in the markets with the property management company. So we actually know quite a few owners in these markets. And that's kind of how we are sourcing deals, is we're constantly looking for, you know, property management business as well as acquiring properties. And so I'll just pick up the phone, call an owner, and I'll start with just talking to them about the actual operations of their property, explain that we have a property management company if they're ever interested in somebody to come manage it. And then after that, I'll say, you know, we're also looking to acquire real estate if they ever considered selling. And so I'm not going in directly with, hey, do you want to sell your property? And I'm asking them, you know, how does property management work at their property? How's it going? C-class properties, we do a lot of C-class. We typically are calling on C-class because that's what we like to acquire. And so, you know, I can kind of, you know, joke around with them and say, you know, how's the management out there? And, you know, what are you guys dealing with? And they always like to talk about that stuff, especially if it's an owner manager.
Yeah,
they'll tell you about everything that's going wrong at the property at that time, just because they probably want to tell somebody. And so I'll even give them hints like, you know, hey, this is what we do. Or, you know, I drove by your property and, you know, it wouldn't hurt if you did this or that. And we've seen it help on our properties. And so that's kind of how we've grown on early stages. Now that we're looking at some of these bigger properties, I do call these owners. A lot of times they're out of state. So it's a little bit tougher to one, get a hold of them, and two, to actually get them to sell. And so a lot of times you're just communicating, learning from them, building a relationship more or less. But we've gotten in with a few brokers that are selling a lot of real estate in these markets. And so I build rapport with them. We've sold a few properties and used them. So they like working with us and they know we close. So a lot of times we're getting calls before the property ever hits the market, and we close quick. We don't retrade, and the owners and or in the brokers know that. And so they like to work with us. We don't really mess around. If it's something we're going to buy, we'll put in an offer that we're comfortable with and we'll close it. And we go after the properties that, it's not A class. They're typically not B classes. They're properties that need a lot of work. And so we go in day one with the expectation that we're going to have to put in some money and get the work done. And that's what we do. And we're also sellers. So those brokers know if they bring us a deal that has a lot of value upside, they'll know that we're going to go in and do it and then probably relist it at some point. And so they like that opportunity as well, as to kind of double end that and get a sale on the backside.
Really smart, really smart. You're dominating your markets. I mean, you only have 450,000 people living in the two markets that you're in.
Yeah.
You're managing 1,600 doors. I mean, you guys are dominating right now. Probably one of the biggest owners in the area, right?
Yeah, there's a few really old school families that have a couple thousand units. And we're obviously in conversations with them as well. But yeah, we have a pretty big market share in both those towns. So that certainly helps.
That's fantastic. Congrats on all your success, Drew. It's amazing. Yeah,
thank you.
So, and you were saying, like, it's funny to have conversations with owner operators, especially in Class C markets. It's property management is a tough business, right? You don't ever get praised when you're doing a good job, but you'll be the first person to get yelled at by tenants and owners if something goes wrong. So yeah, no, it's probably definitely a funny conversation to have with these owners, and a good segue to source deals directly if they no longer want it or deal with the headache. Listening
to point on that, we work with owners that we want to work with as well. And we've had to fire huge clients.
Wow.
With the fact that one, maybe we just don't see eye to eye on certain things, or two, they don't agree with what we're doing with the properties, which is fine. But a lot of times, it is us initiating, saying, hey, we're not going to do this anymore. And, we go our separate ways for the best for both of us. But we're very strict nowadays on who we take on as an owner. And we make sure both of our values align and that they're going to be good to work with. So that's one thing to note as well. Getting into the business, we took on everything, and we realized pretty quick that that's not a great way to scale the business, especially if they don't want to put in the money to the property to fix it, because it ends up just looking back bad on us as the owner or as the manager, because the property needs something and the owner doesn't want to pay for it. And therefore the tenant, writes us the bad reviews and we get the bad press for it. So we're very strict on who we take on as an owner and make sure that both of our values align and everything will work out well for both of us.
Yeah, that's interesting you say that. In such a short period of time, you guys acquired a ton of doors. You're letting go of some huge owner operators because they're not willing to put in the money needed to make it habitable or a good living for the tenants. What are you doing now to vet out future owners and future clients when you're taking them on?
Now, a lot of our clients are coming from referrals. And so a lot of times they're hearing from this owner that has 100 doors with us. And that owner will call, say, hey, I've got a friend that has 150 doors and he wants you guys to come on and manage. And we'll actually vet them through our current owner and say, hey, is this how they operate? Do they do this similar to you? And that owner will typically tell us, like, they're willing to put in the money. They're easy to work with. And as long as you're just doing what you did for me, everything will be good. And so that's where we start. And then we will start talking to that owner. We'll actually walk through a few of their properties and just see how they are upkept. And at that point, we typically have a pretty good idea of if it's somebody we're going to work with, just solely based on the current condition of the units and wow, how they are currently operating them.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. You don't want to be working with slumlords.
Correct. Yeah, it makes it tough.
Yeah. Yeah, I get that. Okay, let's go right into it. You're actively looking to acquire value add opportunities. What are the assets? Like deal size, unit size, typical age? What makes a deal for you? And what are you focused on right now?
Yeah. So there's kind of two sides of it. For myself, on deals that I'm acquiring, it's typically anywhere from 12 to 40 units. And I'm typically working directly with the owner on those deals, and it's C-class. I like them to be fully occupied with low rents, well below market rate. And for me, it's more of a slow burn. I'll get in, I'll clean up the property, I'll do the hallway. I think one thing that a lot of people don't look at right away is like the common area hallways and the entryway. I'll try to go in, I'll put the LVP in day one. I'll paint the walls. I'll clean up the common areas because the tenants are currently living there. So I'm kind of getting a jump start on when those tenants move out, I'm going to do some remodeling and bump rents typically like $150 to $200.
Wow.
Just because they're so far below market. And so that's what I do. And then I typically will buy it and then refinance out, you know, 18 months later. And works out well for me. For the deals that I'm buying with my two partners, we're looking at vintage, typically like 70s or 80s build, hasn't really been touched since then. And so it needs a huge lift, and it's got to typically be at least 100 units that we're acquiring. So there's not a ton of that around here. We did just acquire a 444 unit deal in Cedar Rapids, Iowa, which wow. had 160 vacant units. And so obviously that's going to be a very heavy lift. We typically don't go that heavy, but it was a great deal that we got at a great price. So we moved forward with it. But yeah, typically 100 plus units, try to have on-site management at that point and quite a bit of value add upside, whether it be rents, operations, or obviously just the construction remodel side.
Got it. I like what you said about your personal assets between the 10 to 40, I think he's a 40 something units.
Yeah.
That's like right in the sweet spot where the deals are just so unbelievably juicy. Right. Yeah. Flies right under the radar of institutional capital. You're not fighting with sharks. There's a lot of upside on those deals. And that's actually where I've seen my best deals. That's where I get my it's like infinite returns on those deals every single time.
Yeah. A great example of that is it's like 13 months ago, I bought a 30 unit deal in Cedar Rapids, Iowa. The rents were like $395. It was one and two bedrooms. It was like $395 and $500, but it was fully occupied. I bought it for $1 million. There was actually an open insurance claim on it, which replaced all of the siding and the roofs before I closed.
Wow.
So the property exterior actually looked great. There was a lot of operational issues that I had to take care of day one, whether it be delinquent rents, which not a lot of people talk about. That's obviously a huge issue in C-class investing, is the actual tenants that don't pay rent. And so we're very strict on that and getting the tenants to either pay their rent or, you know, we do evict tenants that don't. And we're pretty swift on that. But we are willing to work with them if they're willing to pay. It's just sometimes you find that the tenants don't, they just don't want to pay and they won't. So I bought the deal 13 months ago. I have slowly basically turned over quite a few tenants, raised rents $100 to $150 a door. And I'm in the process of finalizing the refinance. It'll refinance between 1.5 and 1.6 million. And so just off of that, you know, I put
wow.
it on the but the insurance claim covered a lot of it. And so that just goes to show I'll be able to pull out, you know, typically on that deal, like $250,000 of cash and have no money in the deal. And you just don't find that very often. The higher you go, typically your equity goes down. And so, and it's just slower and you have more moving parts and it's not as, I guess, easy per se. And so I think a lot of people that are just starting out, the bread and butter is like, you know, buy a couple of fourplexes that are close to each other, or buy an eightplex, or, you know, go up to a 30 unit or whatever it may be. But there's a ton of value in that. And you can build a business and easily financial freedom through investing in smaller multifamily deals and not thinking you have to go into these 100, 200, 300 unit deals. You can own 300 units of 12-plexes and you will probably be killing it, you know, because you're not fighting against these institutional investors that are, you're putting in offers and then you got to put in another offer at best and final and they're working the price up. Deals you're working directly with the owner, you can find these deals, you know, 20, 30% below market. And day one, you have a great asset that you can operate with a small company or yourself and really increase the value just by operating it better and cleaning up the property and bringing the rents to market. And so I've done pretty well at that. And I still do that today. I love buying 12 plexes if I can find them. And I plan to do that, you know, forever if I can find them. So, yeah.
I don't blame you, Drew. If you need money for a deal like that, you let me know. I will sell my blood and invest with you for one of those. Yeah,
great that's freaking about it. Awesome. I always explain this to you. Like, if you can find a 12-plex and you can do that, you can raise the rents and refinance and pull out, let's say, $100,000. You can put that into your next deal. And every 18 months, you can literally buy another 12-plex. And 5-10 years down the road, you're going to have like 120 units. 150 yeah. units, and you'll be set, you know, and you're literally just rolling money into these other deals by increasing the value of the current one. So there's a lot of ways to grow in real estate. I believe the best way is to buy those smaller multifamily, fix them up, refi, and then just keep rolling that money into other deals as long as you know what you're doing and you can appropriately underwrite the deal and manage it.
Awesome. So what are you doing? Right? I mean, obviously the markets are going crazy, right? The stock markets, it's crashing. Yeah. Interest rates are going up. Inflation's through the roof. What are you doing to adjust your underwriting, your investment thesis, I suppose, to adjust for the new market changes and that, all the uncertainty that's going on right now?
Yeah. So we use a local bank to finance all of our deals. We don't do bridge loans. Typically, it's anywhere from a 5 or 10 year term. We try to get 10 years. Just last year, we basically refied, or we acquired a lot of properties last year. So we know we're not going to be due for at least 5 years. Personally, I think we're probably going to see higher interest rates over the next 2 to 3 years. Obviously, nobody knows, and I wouldn't trust me by any means, but that's kind of what I think. So we're set personally on deals that we're currently in. As far as future deals, you know, we're underwriting at a 5.5% interest, especially if we know we're going to have to refi after 2 years to get the money out for the construction and things like that. We might even underwrite it at a 6% interest rate, which is quite a bit higher. I mean, we were at like 3.25% a year ago, which is absolutely crazy. So that's kind of what we're doing on the underwriting side on our end. And when we're talking to brokers and other investor operators, we're seeing that 18 months ago, a lot of these groups got into these bridge loans that are due probably in the next 6 to 8 months. And I wouldn't doubt that you're going to have a lot of these groups that underwrote that at a 3.5% interest rate, most likely, for their long-term debt. And they're going to probably get stuck selling their property because of the fact that they're going to be having, you know, they're going to have a 5.5% interest, which they're not going to be able to do on those deals. So they'll end up selling them, which we hope to acquire at that point. But yeah, I mean, the market is certainly changing. I talk to brokers quite often just to get their feel on what's going on. And typically, I just talked to one this morning. He said, you know, bridge loan debt is almost impossible to find right now because it's fluctuating so much. It certainly changes deal C-class properties. A lot of people are buying these on bridge loans because you have to go in and do a lot of work to them. So I think that will change. The C-class market will probably soften a little bit. It was a hot commodity 12 months ago and everybody wanted it. I think you're probably going to see people moving into more like A and B class because you'll just get a longer term loan on it and just hold it. But that's kind of my thesis. We're obviously very conservative. We're buying deals typically that are well below market that need work. And so we're comfortable with it. But yeah, I mean, people will probably end up losing some deals or losing their current investments over the next 12 months. But we're obviously pretty confident in what we're doing and the structure that we have. And also, we work with a local bank. And I think a lot of people should do that if they can. We have a good relationship with them. They've loaned us a lot of money. And in the event that something crazy were to happen, we could probably work with them and figure something out, because they don't want the deal either, obviously. So that's how we would kind of go about if anything were to happen. But we structured our loans now that they won't be expiring anytime soon. So we should be okay.
Got it. So you're pretty much going into a longer term debt day one, locking in a fixed interest rate, correct, as opposed to going through a bridge loan. And is your lender currently offering, I'm sure you're taking out some bridge debt for your purchases. How long are those loan terms for?
So typically we're at 5 year terms on everything.
Oh, wow.
So like this big deal we bought, it's a 5 year term, and we have a construction loan that's also a 5 year term. So nice. We have some time to use that money. And obviously we have some time to ride out this higher interest rate where you would assume, you know, it's not going to last forever, but we do underwrite it at these higher rates as well. So in the fact that that's where we need to be, then we'll be fine. And a lot of people in our markets, rents are increasing quite a bit. And so, you know, with these higher interest rates, we are getting higher rents to offset some of that. So it hasn't been a huge hit, but it obviously affects pricing. You know, we're seeing that on the deals that we're trying to sell as well, as we'll get a call from our broker and say, you know, interest rates aren't 3.5% anymore. These owners aren't going to be paying at a 3.5% interest rate. They're paying at a 6% interest rate. So The value actually does go down when that happens, but it's part of the game. You ride out the highs and you get through the lows.
Yeah. Are you doing any cap rate expansions on your exit and on your refi? So what are you doing to adjust for values?
We are increasing cap rates every year we hold it. It's typically like 0.25 point is the most. And we're buying these at pretty high cap rates because we're working directly with owners, or we're buying them off market through brokers. But that's kind of what we're doing on our end. On these deals, we look at them at a long-term hold, and then we end up just selling them typically based off of the current value of the property and what the brokers are telling us. So in the event that we have to hold on to them, we would like doing that. And all of the assets that I own myself, I look at all of them as, you know, 100-year holds. I would never sell them if I didn't have to or if the offer wasn't right. And so I structure mine in the fact that I want to hold it forever. For our bigger properties, we look at it that way, but typically when the market's good, it's hard to pass up when you can get, you know, $5 million more than you thought you would 12 months ago. So we would end up selling them at that point. But yeah, we were very conservative on our underwriting. And also with rents, you know, we don't project day one a 30% rent increase. We're closer to like 2 or 3%. And just to be, you know, we typically are well over that number, but we're not going to go in and, you know, expect a 15% year over year increase in rents. And we see operators do that because we look at pitch decks all the time and we see some of these operators 10 or 15% year over year. And in my belief, that's just not sustainable long term. It's happening now, especially in these bigger markets. But at some point, you know, rents are going to have to kind of flatline and level off. We're not seeing that yet, but I would assume as time goes on and money gets a little more expensive, I think everybody will be probably looking to not see a $150 a month rent increase, and they'll actually consider moving elsewhere.
No, that's awesome. I love that you're using longer term debt, working with local banks, and the fact that you're vertically integrated and know exactly what you're going to spend. You have 1,600 units to use as track record and as a reference to what real expenses and rent increases will look like. I think that gives you a huge competitive advantage when you're underwriting deals and when you're negotiating with sellers, right? That's awesome. So I'm sure, Drew, that it's pretty darn easy for you to raise money for these deals. What are you doing to raise money for your deals, for your company's deals? And what kind of structure are you giving to your investors to create that win-win for everybody?
So for my deals, I get creative as I can, especially early on. I would buy like a 24 unit deal, for example. And once again, I'm buying this well below the market value. So I would actually have, and this is a good example, it's a 24 unit in Iowa City. It was a $1.2 million purchase price or something close to that. And the owner actually carried back a 15% mortgage, second mortgage for me. So I only had to put 5% down on those deals. And I've actually done that a few times where the bank will put up 80, the current owner will carry back a 15% loan. And then I put down 5%. And then day one, I'm going in there doing all of the work, getting the rents up for the next 12 months. I'll refinance, pay them off that second mortgage, and then just operate it and have one loan with the bank. So I've done that, you know, quite a few times. I do also have personally an investor that will put in money on these deals as a second mortgage. And that's how I've kept all of the equity. Typically, you have to give up some equity on these deals, but he will put up the money as a second mortgage. I'll typically put in 5%. And I'll pay for the construction costs out of pocket. I'll go in, do the work, I'll refinance, pay him off. And then he will just obviously keep rolling that money into other deals. And I'm giving him a 12% interest, which is very good for the most part. And so he obviously enjoys that. And he doesn't want that to go away. So he's constantly looking to do more deals. So that's how I do it myself. People could look at that and obviously say that's over leveraged, which it, you know, typically I'm at 95% leveraged, which is very highly leveraged. But what I always explain to them is these things are so far below market on rents and where it can be. You know, day one, I'm increasing those rents on the current tenants. Not a lot, but I am increasing them. You'll get that turnover. I'll go and do the work and then increase it $150 to $200 on a new tenant. And, you know, before you know it, you're not over leveraged after 5 months because your rents have already increased, you know, 20% on the property. So that's how I look at it. Obviously, it's worked very well. And I'm buying them so far below market that if you look at the actual value of the property, I'm probably, you know, leveraged at 70%. So that's how I've kind of grown personally and been able to keep the equity. As far as our bigger deals, we actually have a group of, you know, anywhere from 3 to 6 people that basically come in as an investor, and they also take out on some deals. We'll either go in as a joint venture where we each put in a certain percentage and each put in just equally the amount of cash that we're getting equity for, or they'll also come in as a debt holder in the second position. And we'll do the same thing on these bigger deals where we'll go in, they'll get an interest rate each month, and then we'll refinance after 12 to 18 months to get the money out and pay them off. So that's really how we've done it and how we've been able to scale without giving up a ton of equity on both these larger deals and the smaller ones. As we keep going, obviously, if you want to keep getting into these bigger deals, we'll probably have to move more into the syndication space. But at this point, we've had, you know, a lot of luck just doing it ourselves and just using a few investor partners on them.
Yeah, that's the thing, right? When you're very local, you're vertically integrated, and you're being very selective on the deals that you buy, it becomes cost prohibitive to syndicate. Right. Exactly. Giving the majority share of the pie to an LP investor. It's been incredibly difficult for me to find deals that fit that profile to give to my own investors. Cause I'm like you, right? Like I go direct to seller. My deals are like 50, 60, 70 cents on a dollar. It would ruin me to give away 60, 70% of the deal. Right. Yep. So I totally get that. I'm interested though. You said that you've been able to get your sellers to carry back a note we've dibbled and dabbled in that arena, probably got one person to say yes. How are you able to instill that much confidence in your sellers, and what kind of terms are you giving them for them to kind of bite the bullet? Like, how do you model it so it works for you, and how do you sell it to them so it may, you know, that they bite on the bait?
Yeah. And so typically how it starts is I just contact the owner direct and I start speaking with them and I build rapport. And then I just ask, honestly, I just go to them and say, hey, you know, I can get 80% from the bank and I can't personally put down 20% on this deal. But if you could carry 15% on, let's just say a 5-year term that's amortized over 30 years at a 5% interest rate. And I say that because that's typically the terms I give out. And each month I'll send you a check for $2,500, which will be your interest and principal. And then after 5 years, I'll refinance it and pay you off. Would that work for you? And I always try to have the numbers on paper and give them to them. So it's like, hey, you're going to get a check each month for $2,500. And they start looking at that. And I think that helps instead of just me trying to explain it to them. So I put it all on paper and I'll email it to them after our conversation, at least to see if there's any interest there. And they're usually like, well, I don't really know what that means. Can you like explain it to me? And I'll say, okay, I'll send you an email with about as clear as information as I can give you. And after I send that to them and they see the numbers, that's kind of what piques their interest. And then it's just an ongoing conversation to get to the closing table. But yeah, I mean, I just explained to them, you know, you're going to get this check every single month. It's for this interest in principal. And typically they'll do it.
Wow.
One way I've grown too is I did that with somebody and then he ended up actually selling me like 3 more properties through that exact same structure. Because every time after 12 months, he was getting paid back. And so he didn't see any like issue doing that because it actually just helped him and he was getting interest on his money, whereas he probably didn't have anywhere else to put it. So that's kind of how I do it. I just ask, you know, a lot of people are afraid to ask or afraid to pick up the phone and call somebody and see if they want to sell their property. I just ask and see what happens. And if they don't want to do it, that's fine too. I'll figure out another way to get the money to close. But I've done it a few times. I've also done a property I just closed, you know, 3 months ago. It was a self-storage facility. It was listed on the MLS. I called the agent. She had never sold self-storage before. And I was brutally honest with her. I said, I've never bought self-storage, so let's try to figure this out. And it was on the market for a long time at like $850,000. And I ended up getting it, or I started talking to them. I actually asked if I could speak with the owner. She said, that's fine. I started talking with the owners. It was an older couple that was looking to retire. And so at that point, I'm like, well, maybe they would want us to owner finance this because they were just looking to retire and they wanted a steady income. And so we ended up getting a deal done at $675,000 and they owner financed 90% of the deal at a really low interest rate. And
let's go get
a check for the next 5 years. And obviously it was well below market. So I've worked on doing that. And I think self-storage is a great asset. It's really hard to find deals in right now, at least from what I've been trying to find. But that's kind of how I structured it. Is I just started talking to them. I got to know them and maybe what they wanted or needed. And they were looking to retire and they just wanted, you know, income for the next 10 years or so.
Wow.
And so we only structured this at 5 years, but for the next 5 years, every month they're going to get a check, you know, in their bank account and they'll be able to live off of it. So that's how I did it. I just got to know them. And then once you start to talk to them, they'll kind of tell you what they're looking for. And once they said they were looking to retire, you know, that kind of piqued my interest. So, you know, maybe they'll be able to sell or finance this. And so I asked and they said, well, sure. And so that's kind of how that came about. I think it's just getting to know the seller and then just asking them and seeing if they're willing to work with you. And I mean, a lot of times you'll get a no, but every once in a while they will say yes to you.
Yeah. Just ask. And, yep. And if they're a little confused on how it works or if they're interested, you send them an email visualizing what that would look like on a monthly basis. And so exactly. It looks like you're typically structuring that second lien position on market terms, right? 30-year AM, 5-year balloon, 5% interest. Yep. Is your primary lender, your first lien lender, okay with that second lien position?
And so that's where relationships come into play, you know, big time. And working with a local bank, if you called any large national bank, they're probably just going to tell you no right off the bat. Mm. I've been able to build a relationship with my local banks. I use 2 of them. And so they're both willing to take on those deals because of the fact that they know I perform and they know I can do it. Nice. And so that's how I've done it. They are aware of it. They're okay with it. And, you know, I'm typically getting the second mortgage paid off after a 12-month period, 12 to like 18 months. So they're happy with it. I mean, at this point, they probably like it. And it also kind of gives them a little more security too, you know, because they're in first lien position. So at the end of the day, they're going to get their money paid back technically if anything were to happen before that second person.
Sure. Sure.
Yeah.
And having, you know, your track record and your assets under management and the long-term relationship right. definitely goes a long way. True. Yep. I would love to check out that email that you send with the how you kind of visualize it to your sellers. Yep. Do you mind sharing that with me? And I could put it in the show notes for the audience as well.
Yes. Yeah. I'll send it to you.
Yeah. No problem. That'd be awesome. Thank you. All right. Yeah. So we got to go to our advice section here. True. You're young. I mean, you graduated college 2016. What are you, 28 years old?
Yep. 28. Yep.
What you've done is just unbelievable. It's a hell of a story. What's the best piece of advice you got early on that you'd want to give to the audience today?
Yeah. The best piece of advice, and I can't remember who told me it, but he just told me to, because I was telling him I wanted to get into real estate, didn't know what I was doing at the time. And he said, just go out and buy that first deal and you'll figure it out. And it was a single family house with a guest house. So I bought it. I had a little property management experience, so I knew what I was somewhat doing, but you know, I never actually owned real estate. I still lived in my parents' basement at the time. So I was buying this thing without any real experience. And I bought it. I started collecting the rent checks every month and the light clicked. It's just like, this is crazy. They're sending me money every month. I have an extra $300 a month to like go to the bar and spend. And so that's what I was like, this is amazing. I need to buy 10,000 of these. And obviously it's a lot harder now that I know, but that's really what clicked. Is like, I bought the first deal. I realized you don't have to be a genius to do this business. You just have to know what you're doing. And so I'm no genius by any means. And I just figured it out as I went. And as long as you know what your expenses are, you know what the taxes and insurance are, and you know what you're doing on the operations side, or you know you have a partner that does, that's all you really need in this business. You don't have to be like the smartest person in the world to own multifamily real estate.
Hell yeah, just go out and do it.
Yep.
Yeah. All right. What does your morning routine look like?
Yeah. So that's changed quite a bit over the last probably year. Before, it was like wake up, get dressed and go to work. There was no like routine or anything, and I'd always feel sluggish. So what I started doing over the past 12 months is I would always get these gym memberships and I would never end up going, or I'd go for a month and then quit. And I realized like somebody has to hold me accountable. I tried Orange Theory. I don't know if you've ever heard of that, where you like pay when you keep skipping classes. And I kept skipping these classes and paying for the missed class. So I was like, this isn't going to work. I have to get as hands-on as possible. So I actually went on Instagram and I looked up like Iowa City trainers and started DMing people. I got a hold of one trainer that was just graduating from Iowa. And I just basically DM'd him and said, hey, do you want to be my personal trainer? And I have a gym at my house. So basically every morning at 5:45, or at least three times a week, he'll show up at my house and we'll do an hour workout. And that's been a huge change for me as far as one, getting up that early, which is great. I do that every day for the most part now. I mean, two, having somebody hold me accountable to actually working out. I've seen huge changes in myself and just, you know, my mental wellness and stability. So that's been a big game changer for me. I work out most mornings, whether it's with the trainer or on the Peloton. And then I'll typically sit down before I go to the office and kind of look over my day and get a solid feeling of where my day's at and what needs to get done and the priority, and to try to get those done right away off the bat, so it's not hanging over me. And then I'll typically go to Starbucks, get a coffee, and then go to the office. So nice. That's my morning routine. And then at nighttime, I go to bed is fairly early. I'm trying to get to bed at like 9:30 or 10. I don't have any kids, so that helps quite a bit. So I'm in bed by like 9:30. I'll read for 30 minutes and then I'll go to sleep. So I try to be asleep by like 10 or 10:30 and then up early. And I've found a lot of value in just like getting a consistent night's sleep and getting up early and working out. So
absolutely.
Yeah.
That's an awesome routine. That's awesome.
Yeah.
Last question, Drew. What are you doing to give back?
Yeah. So I want to do a lot more of like charity as I grow. You know, I don't have a ton of money to give away, I guess, at this point in my life. I hope to get to that point. And I want to try to help on the housing and letting low income people have a better housing. I don't know how that will work, but that's kind of a long-term goal for me. Right now, I get a ton of value and I like to help people get into real estate. So through a podcast that I started with a buddy of mine named Jacob called The Value Add Show, we started putting out shows and I've started getting DMs and text messages from people I know that I never knew would actually be interested in real estate, but they've read a couple books and they've been interested. So right now, a lot of my time is spent, you know, after work or on the weekends meeting with people locally that are interested in real estate. And I try to help them find that first deal. So that's been a ton of value. It actually helps me a lot too. It makes me feel good. And it's always fun trying to help out somebody that's trying to, you know, do what you did. So that's what I do at this moment.
That's awesome. True. Thanks so much for joining the show. If the audience wants to find you, reached out to you, invest with you, send you deals, whatever. How do they reach you?
Yeah, the best is probably on Instagram at Drew J. Coffin. You can also just call or text me. My personal cell is 319-531-0838. You know, a text will certainly be a great way to start the conversation. I would have no issue jumping on a call with somebody that has any questions or, you know, maybe wants to do a deal together.
Wow. Drew, thank you so much for that. I really appreciate your time, brother. Thanks again.
Sure. Thank you.
All right, everybody, that's our show. If you like what you heard, do us a huge favor and give us a 5-star rating and subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts. If you're feeling generous, maybe even tell a friend. Word of mouth helps a lot. If you're interested in being on the show or getting exclusive invites to our Deals and Dollars networking events, you can fill out a form at dealsanddollars.com. That's deals, the letter N, dollars.com. Your hosts were David Choi, Eric Panecki, and John Libretti. The podcast was produced by me, Joshua Perna, with additional editing by Jonas DeHuse and Erwin Castillo. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.